now call today's division meeting on property taxes and local government to order. And I believe first up we have Representative Dabney with House File 406.
Thank you much, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that House File 406 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report. Okay, we can move it later if we need to wait.
No, I don't believe we have quorum yet.
Okay. So, yeah. All right. Thank you much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House File 406 is a little tax bill that only runs, how many pages, Mr. Carlson? 59 pages. Much of the language that's before the committees this year was also in what must have been Representative David's smoking hot tax bill last year, and it's all tied to the elimination of the homestead credit and the creation of the homestead exclusion. Whether you like that or not is immaterial to House File 406. The fact of the matter is the elimination of the credit has a ripple effect across a wide number of tax policies in how we calculate market value. And because of that, we end up with a 59-page bill that attempts to go methodically through tax statute and work at each of the areas where the elimination of the homestead credit had a residual effects that we need to clean up. With me today is Representative, my apologies, Mr. Carlson of the League of Minnesota Cities, and he can speak to the bill.
Welcome to the division, Mr. Carlson, and please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I apologize. I'm a little disheveled. I thought we were going to do the St. Cloud bill first. We did work on this bill last year, as Representative Dabney indicated, with Representative Davids. It was included in the smoking hot tax bill. That's the first time I've been able to say that in a testimony.
Good.
And it was vetoed as a part of that bill, but to my knowledge, the governor had no specific problems with the language that was included in this article of that bill. Just very briefly, when we created the market value homestead exclusion, we reduced the market value for homes throughout the state of Minnesota. Many statutes many portions of statutes in state law are tied to the term market value, which was not defined in statute. And as we sat with your staff, Joel Michael and Department of Revenue staff and Senate staff, we uncovered 59 pages worth of statutes that really needed clarification and definition for the term market value. And this bill is the outgrowth of that effort. I kind of call this my pro bono bill of the year because most of this really doesn't affect cities. Much of this is just really trying to make consistent the treatment of the term market value throughout Minnesota state statutes. The real operative sections of the bill, and I have a testimony that I gave you, I think are sections 24 and 25. Of the bill, where we really try to define taxable market value and estimated market value, and then we basically use those terms throughout the rest of the bill. You'll see most of the additions are inserting the term estimated or taxable before the term market value throughout state statute. And then finally, I guess I would just say that one other thing we decided, I should say, your staff and I decided to do was basically move a section of law related to school aids that was actually referenced in the LGA formula and the county program aid formula, move that to Minnesota Statutes 273 so that all of the aid programs for local governments point to the same general property tax law in Minnesota Statutes 273. And that recodification occurs under Section 110, I'm sorry, Section 111 of the bill. But Mr. Chair, I could try to answer any specific questions the committee has. I do believe this bill was fairly carefully vetted last year by the full tax committee. I know there's many new members, but I could try to stand for any questions.
Certainly. Questions from members? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have a representative here from the Department of Revenue?
Welcome to the division, and please state your name for the record.
Hello, I'm Heather Bessler from the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Heather, I just have a simple question. Does the Department of Revenue support this bill?
The Department of Revenue, I can't speak to what the Department of Revenue supports or what they don't support, but they believe this bill is needful to codify what has already been done, what's already being done for the market value exclusion.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. So is there anything in this bill you'd like to point out that would be a problem?
No, Representative.
Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members, I might point out that there is a revenue impact for these provisions. It's basically an impact on property tax refunds. It's the interactions and income tax interactions. And I imagine that Ms. Bessler, because there is an impact, is being neutral on their support. But if you read also the revenue estimate that's been provided, you will find some detail mostly pointing to special taxing districts and the anticipation that there would be an increase in levy authority. And I believe that that's the basis for the revenue estimate and the fiscal impact.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and Ms. Schill, I think, covers it well. The intent and the effort on this bill is to be neutral. It's not to raise revenue. It's not to decrease revenue. It's not to bias towards one jurisdiction or type of jurisdiction or another. It's simply to deal with the ripple effect of the elimination of the homestead credit and the ancillary impacts that had in state multiple places. Apparently 110 in state statute.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, would you like to describe in a little more detail the revenue impact of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I think perhaps Ms. Schill could walk through the information in members' packets in detail.
Mr. Chair and members, there is a single page revenue estimate here. And it anticipates, with the increase in levy authority compared to current law, that there would be interaction with property tax refunds of $200,000 in fiscal 15 and each year thereafter. And then the income tax interaction would be $150,000 in each year thereafter for a total of $350,000 per year beginning in fiscal 15.
Further questions from members? All right, and I do see we have a quorum, so we can officially move your bill.
Mr. Chair, then I would like to move House File 46 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report, and thank the chair and members for this hearing.
Very good. Thank you.
May I take this? Thank you. And what is the other? Oh, that works. All right. Representative Dorholt, welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Chair Dabney.
I'd like to move House File 377 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Dorholt, you have an author's amendment, is that correct?
I do have an author's amendment.
The chair moves the A1 amendment be before the committee. This amendment, members, gets the bill in the order that the author wishes. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the H377A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Dorholt, to the most interesting and unique city local option sales tax in the state of Minnesota, sir.
Thank you. Which is what you have before you. HF 377 extends the current local option sales tax that is in place for 6 cities in the St. Cloud area, including St. Augustus, St. Cloud, St. Joseph, Sartell, Sauk Rapids, and Wade Park. Today with me, I have representatives from the entire area, along with Representative Tammet Tice from St. Cloud and Tim O'Driscoll from the city of Sartell. And I also have Shauna Johnson from the city of Wade Park and Sarah J. Nickel from the city of Sartell to speak on behalf of the bill.
Excellent. Please come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Who's first? Ma'am, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon, by the way. My name is Sarah Jane Nickel, and I'm a city council member for the city of Sartell. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 377, the extension of the St. Cloud area local option sales tax. I want to thank Representative Dorholt and all of our area legislators for their support of this important effort for our region. As you heard from Representative Dorholt, this is a unique circumstance of 6 cities working together to share resources to help build the infrastructure of our region that serves a vast portion of central Minnesota that goes well beyond the borders of our 6 cities. The 6 cities of St. Augusta, St. Cloud, St. Joseph, Sartell, Sauk Rapids, and Wake Park have worked together in some combination since 2002 to collect a local option sales tax in each of our communities. Those funds are then distributed based on a joint powers agreement between the cities. According to our agreement, the first $900,000 goes to a regional project that the cities select in common. Past projects have included improvements to the St. Cloud Regional Airport and the building of St. Cloud Regional Library. The rest of the money is distributed based on a formula that the cities have created for regional projects within each city. For instance, in Sartell, the largest portion has gone to construct several regional roadway corridors that are vital to the economic development in the region, particularly regional medical facilities that expanded our tax base and created excellent paying jobs as well as necessary services for our region. We've also used sales tax for regional park and trail improvements and other regional amenities located in our community, and some critical land acquisitions. Finally, as an elected official myself, it is important to ensure that these sales tax dollars are well spent, which is why there is a significant community discussion about what types of projects should be funded and ultimately why we will have a referendum in each of our cities to approve participation in the sales tax and the projects that will be funded. I would like to now turn the presentation over to Shauna Johnson, City Administrator from Wake Park.
Ms. Johnson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Shauna Johnson, and I am the City Administrator for the City of Wake Park. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to add a few additional things based off this. We are looking for a 20-year extension on our sales tax, and really one of the things that we want to be able to do is be able to look at potential projects for bonding and have some potentials of doing that. The extension of this will begin in 2018, and for our purposes, we need the time from now until then to be able to work with our communities and work through an education process that we go through to identify those kinds of projects. Ms. Nichols did mention some of the projects that we've worked on before. You know, we are a large regional center. Our population expands over 100,000 in population. And I can tell you from the community of Wake Park, we're a city of just over 7,000. And in our community alone, we have over 100,000 vehicles that go through a community in a day. And with that, what it does is it places great needs for services in our community that we can utilize sales tax dollars to help be able to pay for some of those things. Our sales tax dollars go towards capital expenditure projects and primarily have been used to be funded for transportation issues. Other types of projects that we have utilized have been for parks and trails and community facilities, libraries, and our municipal airports. all of which have regional significance. From our community's perspective, we believe that a community that does have over 100,000 trips in our community that that benefit from the roads that they drive on, the parks that they're able to visit, that it's sales tax is a great use of funds to be able to provide those services rather than utilizing our sales tax, or excuse me, our property tax dollars, which are used and only paid for by those property tax owners within our community. So we're looking at those types of things. Ms. Nichols did mention that we do it based off of a formula. It is unique. I don't believe that there's an example of this anywhere throughout the state where sales tax is collected in those six cities and then brought together and distributed amongst all the other communities on a formula basis, which is 50% population and 50% the sales tax that is collected within your community. And so we disperse that amongst there. And so we do believe that the extension of the sales tax is important for us to continue looking at options to fund our capital expenditure projects. We're looking at the 20-year extension to be able to allow us the ability to plan for our projects and be able to have the ability to bond for these types of things. When we're doing that, and as many of you know, bond projects and the size of projects that we have, takes those types of years to be able to pay for some of those types of improvements. So those are the things. In our communities as well, you know, our boundaries really are really not there. Our communities all benefit from the projects that go on in each of our communities. For example, in Waite Park, we have a splash pad as well as our Babe Ruth park that includes all of Rivers Edge Park. That is a park that generates and is used by many of the individuals, not just in our six cities, but throughout the central Minnesota area. Those same things are true with the St. Cloud Library and many of the other projects that go on within our communities where they truly are regional significant. And we believe that the extension of this supports what we're asking for and would like to have that be considered. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Representative Faust, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do either of you know the total dollars raised by this on an annual basis? Just ballpark is good enough.
Council member?
Mr. Chair, representative, the dollar amount for 2012, I believe, was just under $9 million.
Okay.
And Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much would the property taxes increase on a home in St. Cloud or one of these towns if you raised that much from property taxes instead?
Ooh. Ms. Johnson, in Waite Park?
Mr. Chair and Member Faust, I'm not sure that I can give you the specific dollar amount that would be based off of that particular amount. You know, with some of the changes that have happened in taxes over the years as far as levies and some of those things, it's really difficult, I think, for me, to be quite honest with you, to provide you that specific dollar amount.
That's fair enough. I'm sorry. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Thank
you. Let's approach it from a different direction. What is the total budget of these six towns put together? If you got a better shot at that number.
Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Member Faust, I can tell you from Waite Park, our budget is about $5 million. I can also maybe just reiterate a little bit of that. You know, from our city, we collect, of that $9 million, about $900,000 of that. If I was to look at that as to what it would do to our tax rate, I could tell you that that would probably be about 6 or 7% on our tax rate.
Okay.
And that's probably the best guesstimate I can give you on that.
That's close enough. Thank you very much.
All right. Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, you commented about the formula for the distribution to the different cities, but you also commented that you provide funding for projects of regional significance. And how do you arrive at a decision among the cities? And I'll tell you why I'm asking the question. I also happen to serve on our Capital Investment Committee, and there was discussion about a rail line through southern Minnesota, and the counties that it goes through, they have to have unanimous consent among the counties, and they talked about the rather high threshold. So I'm just curious how you arrive at consensus about a project that's of regional significance, especially if one of the cities has some concerns about it or isn't particularly interested in the project.
Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Member Carlson, I'm sorry, I can't.
Carlson.
Okay, my eyes are not always, they're kind of deceiving. How that works is that each individual community has to go to its own voters and have a referendum. And the projects that they want to include for their community projects, have to be on that referendum and be approved as part of that referendum. We also, before we go to those referendums, we work collectively with the six cities and determine what regional project or possibly plural, it could be projects depending on, that we're going to do collectively. In the past, what we've done has been the library and the municipal airport, where the first $900,000 that was collected went to those two projects. And in each of those individual cities, that's part of the overall referendum that gets voted on, and you have to vote for that in order to be able to have the sales tax move forward. So there has been times when not all the cities have in the past been successful with getting their referendum, or maybe some have supported some projects and not others, and those cities then move forward with the projects that they have the voter referendum approved for.
Representative Carlson?
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm not totally clear then. I understand what you were saying in the earlier testimony about projects that each city would endorse or have a referendum on. But what I'm interested in is a project that's of regional significance that you said part of the sales tax money can be used for, and how you arrive at that decision. And especially if one of the cities said that they weren't interested in that particular regional project and didn't want to participate, what happens then?
Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I can tell you that what we've done is we have some of our community input sessions, and we work collectively with those cities to determine what that project would be, and there has to be consensus on that to be able to proceed. And it hasn't been an issue in the past. We've identified those projects at our council and administrative levels and discussed those things based off the information and input that we've gotten from the public.
So, Mr. Chairman, then you've always reached consensus, is what you're saying, at least up to this point.
Ms. Johnson.
On that regional project, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I think it's worthwhile to note that in the initial passage of this special law and then its first extension, there were two specific regional projects that were identified in advance that the cities were required to join a joint powers agreement for, right, to fund them. The first one was the airport. The second one was the regional library. The law at that time required that the first dollars go to those regional projects. They also required that the cities approve those projects. Otherwise, the sales tax would not be imposed in those cities, and they would not benefit from any of the additional revenue raised.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dorholt, I wonder if one of your witnesses could tell me, what is the total population of the six cities, roughly, in that area?
Ms. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, approximately 120,000 population of our cities.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dorholt, I don't know if you're new to this, but I have not been a big fan of local option sales taxes. I know there's at least one other member sitting around here, I won't mention her name, who also has not been a big fan over the years. But I have to say that if we're going to have a local option sales tax, this is an excellent model. I mean, how the six cities getting together, I think, is just a wonderful model of regional cooperation in putting things together and agreeing on what. And I might mention, Representative Lincheski, it sounds a little bit like a local option sales tax fiscal disparity program, where you have all, I know that would be dear to your heart. but it is. When you can put six cities together like this and they come together and they're looking at into the future, what might be projects they need that not only for their cities but for the region. We could use more of that around the state, actually, whether or not it's a local option sales tax or other methods to do that, because I think when you do that, you're getting the best value for the dollar to your residents when you do things like this. So Representative Dorholt, I have never been a big fan of local option sales tax, but I give you credit for carrying this bill, and thank you. And, I mean, you know, this is an extension, and I just think the efforts of the cities there and are doing a wonderful job. So,
Representative Dorholt, that is high praise. Especially for a freshman who I don't think brought treats for the hearing. Particularly high praise.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. I mean, like I said, this is a team effort of mm-hmm. six cities and who work very closely. And as Ms. Johnson implied to, you drive through our community, you can't tell the boundaries very mm-hmm. easily. So we have to work closely together.
Thank you, Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I really just have a comment more than a question. You know, I too just really have a problem with the local sales tax, and I've expressed that to you before, and expressed that last hearing also. But the thing that really bothers me about this is that you're taking the $9 million, and if you would put that on your property taxes instead, your property taxes would still be lower than what they probably are in my district. In fact, I'd be willing to bet on that. And yet, you're using the sales tax from my residents when they come to St. Cloud and shop, or any of these other towns, and then you're using that to hold down the property taxes so that when we're both competing to drive a business into our community, and now you're using my tax dollars to keep your taxes down so that I'm at a disadvantage to your cities. And so it really, you know, this kind of thing really does bother me, but I guess I won't get to vote no today, but anyway. But like I say, just a comment.
Thank you, Representative Faust. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 377? Okay. Representative Dorholt, any closing comments besides a reminder of St. Cloud Days tonight?
5 to 7 at the Kelly Inn. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 377, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Members, it's approaching 5 o'clock, so we should be talking about fermentation. Representative Falk. There you go. Representative Keel, would you like to move House File 660 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report?
Sure, I would gladly move that.
Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank
Representative
you.
Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Keel, for moving the bill, and thank you, members, for your time. House File 660 is intended to provide some clarification as to what is considered personal property versus real property. Part of this stems from the fact that we have three co-equal branches of government, although sometimes our friends in the judicial branch maybe confuse what the legislative intent or some of the intent of interpretation of our laws are. And this gets to the fact that overall we look at industrial processes, manufacturing, other things, and typically the equipment used in the production of a product is considered to be personal property, not real property. This comes to a point where some of the tanks involved in different processes have been interpreted to be considered real property, when in fact they're part of the production process and instead should be looked at as personal property. And so to help understand this issue, I've got with me Mr. Tim Rudnicki from the Minnesota Biofuels Association and Mr. Don Gales, who is the CEO of Guardian Energy. And I also have Mr. Ward Innes with us, and he's representing Summit and Shell's Breweries. And with that, I'd like to allow my witnesses to testify before the committee.
Thank you, Representative Falk. Who's up first? Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Rudnicki, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association. And we are here to speak in support of House File 660 because we think it does three important things. It resolves some confusion. It avoids heavy costs on the monetary front and the social welfare front, and also it resolves some public policies that are contrary to one another. And I'll just briefly summarize what some of these real issues are. First of all, I think it's clear from the Minnesota Supreme Court that they pretty much tell us, or anybody examining these tax provisions, that if there's a debate over the interpretation of a relevant provision of a statute, they say it should be waged at the legislature, not in the judicial branch. And that's really important because also from the court, we're reminded that the wisdom and social effects of tax provisions lie with this body, the responsibility of the legislatures, not the courts. And here's what's really confusing. I'll try to distill this down. There may be some in this room who would say there is no confusion, there is no costly problem, or there may not be any policies contrary to one another. We beg to differ for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you look at Minnesota Statute 272.03 and some of its relevant provisions, you'll see virtually everything is real property unless there's an exclusion. And that's great until you get to another provision of the statute that says, but there's an exception to the exclusion. And without getting into all the particular words, it goes something like this. If it has a roof, ceiling, walls, and floor, then you can consider this an exception to the exclusion. And what that means in the biofuels industry is that process tanks, vessels of various sorts, various sizes and shapes that are strictly that process, they're not storage, have been interpreted to be real property rather than personal property. So that's one confusion, and what I submit to you is what's really happening is there's an attempt to take a square peg and pound it into a round hole. If it looks like, roof, ceiling, walls, floor, therefore it must fall into that particular legal analysis. It's almost like trying to make a legal fiction work. And what is problematic about that is it involves costly litigation on a case-by-case-by-case basis to resolve this matter. And in a number of situations, it's not resolved the matter. And what's more important is that exclusion I'm talking about and the exception to the exclusion go back to a statutory provision that was enacted in 1985. Now, if we look at the history of biofuel production in the state of Minnesota, there was very little biofuel activity. It was actually in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, where there began to be a lot of development in the biofuel industry. So it almost makes one wonder, could the legislature really have intended in 1985 to address something that was going to happen 10 years down the road in terms of development of the biofuel industry? And furthermore, is a provision that's 28 years old, which may not have been intended to be applicable to the biofuel industry, really relevant and really the approach we want to use today? After, in fact, this morning we heard some bills where the legislature is considering expanding the role of biofuels in Minnesota, displacing more petroleum with biofuels. So that gets me to the issues of contrary positions. But just to give you some examples before we get to that about what's confusing, we have a statutory interpretation where probably an irrelevant or inapplicable statute is being pushed into the analysis of a process tank in a biofuel facility. Then we have an interesting situation, and what that means is real property is considered personal property, and then it's considered real property again. That's the problem. That's part of the confusion. And then we have from the Minnesota Department of Revenue a guidance document regarding capital equipment, which is applicable today. And what this means is that if you have these process tanks, they're treated as real property. They're treated as a capital equipment. You submit your rebate form, and the Department of Revenue submits a refund check. But to do that, they're implicitly stating that you have personal property. So we have the court case, we have the statute that's confusing, and we have internal guidance documents also that are confusing. Further, we have a history where these particular tanks were treated explicitly as personal property. In fact, if you go to a guidance document that was prepared for the Agricultural Committee of the Minnesota Ag Assessors Association, it explicitly states that fermentation tanks, beer wells, and liquefaction tanks are exempt from real property. So we have a history where these process tanks have been treated as personal property, and we have some confusion about the interpretation of statutes which try to convert personal property to real property. And finally, with regard to the situation we're facing being contrary to public policy, going back to the biofuels objectives in the state of Minnesota, there's a clear intent to expand the role of biofuels to displace more petroleum. There are some significant economic reasons for that. Right now, the biofuels industry is supporting about 12,600 jobs in the state of Minnesota. The biofuels industry is currently pumping about $5 billion into the state economy. And every energy dollar we spend on biofuels and we keep in the state of Minnesota is something we're not doing if we're buying crude oil from out of the state. So it's a very positive economic feature. There's some incredible social and environmental benefits that come with biofuel production within the state of Minnesota as well. And most importantly, again, there are policies that are driving the industry, that are encouraging the industry to produce more, to make more biofuels available in the state, to give consumers fuel choices at the pump. And at the same time, we're confronted with these tax policy interpretations that thwart any effort to really either expand production in the state of Minnesota or even for those who may be considering new construction. It's a big barrier. So we're pleased to be able to come to you to find a solution to get rid of the confusion, to harmonize the biofuel development policy with the tax policy, and to eliminate costs that are borne by producers and counties as they have to litigate these matters. So this bill, we believe, is a great solution all around.
Thank you, Mr. Runicki. Is it Mr. Bales?
Gales.
Gales, my apologies. Mr. Gales, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, sir.
I'm Don Gales, and I'm CEO of Guardian Energy and Ethanol Production Facility in Janesville, Minnesota. I'd like to start by giving a brief description of the ethanol process. There has been a handout presented to everyone, and I would walk through that. The ethanol process is a biological process. Like when we all want to go drink our fermented product tonight that comes in a can, the presses that make those cans is considered personal property because they manufacture and do their thing. That's their product. Our product is a liquid product. It's a biological product, so it's got to be in a controlled where the enzymes work and the yeast work. And so consequently, our process equipment is tanks and vessels. We have a lot of other tanks and vessels at our facilities that are storage tanks. We believe they're real property. Our discussion is about what is process tanks. We'll go inside the first page, and it just has an oversight of the dry mill ethanol process. This is what predominantly makes up the 1.1 billion gallon industry within your state. Most of these facilities are based in rural America. Every facility has a lot of local direct and indirect jobs. But basically, as a highlight, the ethanol facilities are corn-based. The corn comes in, it's buyed from local producers and commercial companies. It's stored. It's ground into a real fine flour. The round flour is mixed with enzymes and water, and it goes into the cook process or the liquefaction process, where we need to get it to 185 degrees, and we got to keep it there for between 90 and 120 minutes because that starts breaking down the starch. From there, it's going to move over to the fermentation tanks, which are the next set of tanks, and there it'll be in there for about 60 hours. And in there, we add some more enzymes to turn that starch into sugar, and then we turn a bunch of yeast loose, and the yeast eat the sugars and create the alcohol. So that's the process that we do. After we've done that, then it goes to what's called separation, the distillation columns, and we separate the alcohol from the water and the solids. The solids are made into distiller's grains. The alcohol is sold as fuel. Going to the next page, I'm just going to quickly go through these tanks, and we're describing the facility of Alcorn Clean Fuels in Claremont, Minnesota. Is a liquefaction tank on a 50-million-gallon plant. There's approximately 90,000 gallons. Again, the product resides in these tanks for less than 120 minutes at 185 degrees. This is where the enzymes do their work. Flipping over to the next page, in order to maintain proper control within those tanks, all those tanks are agitated and need to be circulated. And you got to put the stuff back in the proper places to get the right mixture. Flipping to the next page is after liquefaction, we go into what's called the fermentation tanks. There we're going to add some more enzymes, and we're going to add the yeast 60 hours. The ethanol industry in Minnesota is called a batch fermentation, because every time we fill a fermenter and then we empty it, we disinfect it. We want to make sure we get all the bacteria out of it. So we use caustic and really hot water, and we clean it and we rinse it to make sure there's no bacteria so we get the best fermentation going forward. So it'll stay in those fermentation tanks. We fill them at about 700 gallons a minute, and it stays in there between 60 and 65 hours. Flipping to the next page just shows a picture of these tanks. These are made of stainless steel tanks so they don't corrode, because we have to control the pH inside these vessels as we're doing the enzymes and everything. We do have pH control. We'll use anhydrous ammonia, urea, and these types of things to control pH in the process. We got to keep things very accurate. Flipping to the next page, in order to make fermentation work so the yeast create really good alcohol or really good beer, is we got to control the temperature. In order to make things work, if we don't keep that fluid at about 90 degrees, the yeast will die. If we get over 95 degrees, they get really sick. So consequently, we really got to control the temperature in this. So we are constantly circulating the stuff and using cooling water to cool down that process to keep it at 90 degrees and to make sure the yeast works as good as possible. Flipping to the next page, it's a technical page, and we've had the question asked, well, how do we convert all this? This just shows the hours through fermentation, how the yeast change. The bricks number is basically the conversion from the sugar to alcohol, and the longer we stay in there is how the process goes. Flipping to the next page, it has a picture of the beer well. Again, after 60 hours, it's pushed to the beer well so we can clean that fermenter out and get it to the next batch. It'll sit in there between 10 and 12 hours before it moves on to distillation. Distillation in the ethanol industry is usually three columns in series. One separates the solids out, one separates the rest of the water out, and the third one's just the finishing one to get it so we have very dry alcohol. The solids on the next page go to a building called the Distiller's Grains and Soluble Storage. And these facilities are big, and this is where the distillers needs to cool. Because if we don't get it down to ambient air temperature, it'll cake up, it'll stick, and it's a problem. So in this building, the DDGs will go in there, and you usually will put a pile out every day, and you want it to sit in there from 12 to 24 hours in order for it to finish its drying and getting to ambient air temperature. The next page shows those actual piles. It shows the walls, the ceilings, and everything. It shows two piles, and it shows an empty area. That shows that they're rotating their piles and making sure they're getting done and getting things completed. We call all these real property. The next one's the finished storage tank. There's no process going on in these tanks. It's just storage. It's real property. The other two tanks are what's called day tanks. Those tanks, again, they're storage tanks. There isn't a process that goes on in those tanks. Our industry's always considered them as real property. So, is it complicated? Renewable fuels, unlike any other industry within this state, definitely requires process tanks to create our product. It's just that we have a lot of big tanks in order to do this. If you go back to those liquefaction tanks, if you went to the early stages of the industry, they didn't exist. It was a series of pipes. So why did we go to a tank system Why? Because it was cheaper, it's more energy efficient, and we found out with circulation and agitation we could get better control and get better output. Our industry didn't exist when the present property tax statutes were written. We weren't even on the radar screen. So it's hard to write tax policy for an industry that doesn't exist. There's a lot of confusion between counties. Counties in different parts of the state classify these tanks differently within them. Is it confusing? As you look at the aspects today being personally involved, is what is and what isn't real property had always been considered personal property up until the sugar beet case of 2009. From inception in 1995 to the first ethanol plants going on stream up till 2009, all process tanks, all distillation columns and everything were always considered personal property, and that's the way they were. Is it costly? Minnesota has been a leader in renewable energy. All the present renewable liquid fuels processes that are commercially available are biological processes. If we want to go to the next stage of advanced biofuels, whether it's cellulosic, whether it's LG diesel, whether it's fiber to ethanol, it's going to require more process tanks. So do we want to endorse and support a growing renewable energy industry that has done a lot for the economic activity in the state of Minnesota? This is very important to that aspect. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gales. Representative Lincheski.
Mr. Chair, or I was wondering if we could hear from the department on this. If the first testifier had a lot of issues with what the Department of Revenue mm-hmm. is doing and what the confusion is, and I just wanted to hear what their thoughts are on this.
Perfect. Thank you, Chair Lincheski. Mr. Hagan. Welcome to the committee, sir. Welcome back, I think, is actually the proper thing. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Hagan. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division. And, Mr. Chair, to Representative Lincheski's question, first of all, the Department of Revenue really doesn't have a position on this, in as much as we feel it's a policy position. The determination to exempt or tax properties is at the discretion of the legislature. Of course, there's a cost to all taxpayers when property is exempted. I am told by experts, I'm not an expert on ethanol tanks or these complex properties, but I'm told by our experts and some of the leading experts in the Association of Assessing Officers that the law is very clear. It provides them with good guidance on what they need to do. Additional guidance was provided by the sugar beet case in Renville County some years back that made it very clear from a sugar beet perspective that these tanks were in fact taxable. Now on February 21st, just a few days ago, the Minnesota Tax Court issued what was called a findings of facts and conclusions of law, specifically addressing the question of whether beer wells and fermentation tanks and a number of other tanks were taxable as real property or exempt as personal property. And this court decision, or those findings of fact, made the determination that these tanks were taxable as real property. They concluded that in all cases, and they're going ahead with the evaluation phase of the trial, but they concluded in all cases on these unidentified properties that they were in fact taxable as real property. And in that findings of fact, if I can find it. They did identify a number of activities that were. Can you find that? Mm-hmm. Okay. In that most recent findings of fact by the Minnesota Tax Court, the Tax Court said the clarifier tank, sludge thickening tank, liquefaction tanks, fermentator tanks, beer well tank, beer stripper columns, rectifier columns, and methanator tanks, all foreign language to me, I apologize, and equipment are exempt from taxation under 272.03 sub 1, but their exterior shells are excluded from Minnesota statute. It's written a little difficult to follow. Are excluded under Minnesota statute 272.03 sub 1 C double I from the exemption and are therefore taxable as real property. So it kind of is, as an earlier witness was talking about, another part in the law, it sort of takes away but adds it back. So it's saying although they do perform a lot of functions that are unique to production and other types of equipment that are exempt. In this case, that these properties, because they have a structural insulation or temperature control, are therefore taxable as real property. And one other point I'd like to make that Mr. Reinecke pointed out to me, who is our expert on complex properties, was that ethanol tanks cost approximately $200 million, or ethanol plants cost approximately $200 million to construct, and from the point of to get into production phase. And of that, somewhere between 10 and 15% of that is taxed for property tax purposes as real estate. The rest is exempted as machinery or equipment.
Excuse me, Representative Lincheski, do you have further questions for Mr. Hagan?
Well, Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up, so if I'm hearing you correctly, you feel the court has confirmed that the way the Department of Revenue is handling it is in agreement with you, but you're saying you don't have a position, meaning the legislature, of course, while the court is recognizing that what the Department of Revenue is doing is fine, the legislature could change that and provide a tax benefit to this sort of activity, shifting it to the other property taxpayers.
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, that's correct. And we have taken some guidance and direction from the courts, but we're in parallel tracks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was looking at now the bill and the revenue note, and something that caught my eye with the revenue note was that the impact would be on an unknown amount of property and other types of facilities that may also qualify. So my concern is that the revenue note may be understating the impact of the bill, because then when I look at the bill, it talks about biofuel facilities, which has been most of the testimony here today. And my question is of the department, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
Breweries, distilleries, dairies, regardless of attachment to the to or insulation in real property and so on. So, you know, my definition always, real property was land, buildings, and those things permanently attached. You know, a simple definition, and I understand there's been statutes referenced where there's various exemptions. But my real question is, just how broad is this really? Because I think the revenue note reflects the biofuel industry, the ethanol plants, but the bill itself goes far beyond that. And when you talk about the tax shift that takes place, you know, we have a lot of communities with dairy facilities and so on that would bring about a shift onto other property tax payers in those communities, let alone what the cost might be to the general fund, which seems to be under the revenue note not that dramatic. But then when we look at all of the facilities across the state, another growing industry is wineries. They've been growing rapidly across the state. So my question then, with that long background, is this revenue note understated in terms of what the potential impact would be on the state and other communities?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, without directly answering your question, I can certainly say it's a very slippery slope. When you start to move any point on taxation, expanding the definition of what's taxable or what's exempt, there's a lot of unintended consequences that could and often do take place. It opens up a whole bunch of potential for litigation for various industries like you're referring to. And to be clear, on the wineries and the breweries and issues, properties like that, we are certainly not advocating it at this time, based on our understanding of what's real and what's personal property, that these properties are taxable as real property for the wineries and the beer bats, or whatever the proper term is.
Mr. Chairman, just a
Representative Carlson
comment. You referenced unintended consequences, and yet when I read the bill, I mean, it's pretty clear that there are other industries that are going to be covered by the bill, and therefore my interest in what the revenue note is really stating. But I'll stop there and listen to others with their questions.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think to maybe Representative Lincheski and Representative Carlson, this is partially being driven by a court case that happened with the sugar beet facility in Renville County. And as a result of that court case, Department of Revenue is now applying that standard to basically all of these types of vessels and tanks, which they had not been doing before. So the tank holding the milk at the dairy, you know, had previously been classified as real property, or excuse me, personal property, through that interpretation is now being looked at as real property. And as part of the fairness issue here is that with these processes, whether, you know, any type of industrial manufacturing, we typically look at what it takes to produce the product as personal property. And so in the macro sense, because of that one court case, we're looking at the vessels or the tanks that are in utilized in this process as now no longer being part of the production process, but now as part of the real property of what's located there. And so a lot of this is really being driven by this court case, which I think that they erred in their judgment, and maybe Revenue could speak to that a little bit. That to my understanding, your direction is coming from that court case, which I think that was reached in a point that really didn't understand all of the implications of it, because when looking at the Renville sugar beet storage facility, that was really more storage, where these process or tanks and vessels are places where processes are taking place.
Mr. Hagen, do you care to respond to Representative Falk?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Falk. Yes, we definitely have taken a lot of direction from the Supreme Court decision, as we are bound to do. It has a force and effect of law, and what does gives us a little more clarity of that we are in fact. And to speak to the question, you're right, Representative, that we were not, the ethanol industry is pretty new, and we didn't react immediately to the construction of these and identify real and taxable properties. It was a slow process that when it came on our radar screen and we became aware of it, we've sort of evolved. It is, it's a complex assessment issues, and we evolved to the point, following a lot of direction from the Supreme Court, to the point where we feel there's clarity on the taxation. What's added a lot more clarity in our perspective is the court, the findings of fact and conclusion, finding of conclusions and facts that the tax court just issued a few days back, specifically identifying, which, Representative, you may not even be aware of that yet, specifically clarifying that these tanks in an ethanol application, not a sugar beet application, but an ethanol application, are taxable as real property.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's one of the things where I do believe that the court may have erred in its judgment. And one of the arguments that to maintain the temperature or such, basically some of the definitions of what constitutes a building and what it's protecting on the inside, as Mr. The gentleman from Guardian spoke to, that you have to keep the process at certain temperatures to be able to make the yeast work and other things. And so there's a whole lot of moving parts here, and I think that we have to clarify this. And part of the issue about this being a shift is in taxation is, for a long period of time, these were not part of basically what was considered real property. And so because of this court case, I think it has artificially increased the value of what would be considered real property in a lot of these instances. And so then to make the argument, well, now that you're just shifting tax, burden to other areas, it may not be the right argument, because it was that argument or that point was reached in error to begin with.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hagen, is this property being consistently classified as real property in all counties across the state of Minnesota today?
Mr. Hagen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, an excellent question, and the answer is no, it's not. I believe these properties exist in 17 counties, and 13 of those counties are taxing the properties according to the Supreme Court decision and our instruction. There are three counties, I believe, that are not currently taxing them, but it's not the first time that counties have failed to follow the direction of the Department of Revenue, which is a subject that I'd like to broach on a separate date.
Representative Torkelson.
I'm not going there.
Yeah, good choice.
So if it's not being consistently applied today, do you feel that, I'm not going to say that the court's erred, but if the legislature would clarify this situation, do you feel that the legislature has the right or the power to clarify this situation?
Mr. Hagen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, clearly the legislature has the right to clarify it, to exempt all ethanol plants, if that was your decision.
If I may, Representative Torkelson, Mr. Hagen, I'm assuming Representative Torkelson means by clarifying that we take some action. I assume not taking an action would also communicate something. It would
that fair, Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that. Based upon the court decisions that we're aware of and are before us, that the legislature not taking an action would demonstrate that the legislature was supportive of the court's decisions.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't taking a position. I was just trying to figure out what our rights and responsibilities
Absolutely.
Are. When was that Sugar Beet court case decision made?
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Sugar Beet decision dates back to 2007.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so did the department immediately after 2007 tell assessors to reclassify this property?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the decision was in August of 2007. I'm not real sure at what point in time we got more engaged in the process. It certainly, my memory was it was not immediately, but as we became more aware of the inconsistencies, we struggled to, we tried to get assessors to assess all these properties uniformly as directed by the Supreme Court.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it days or months or years?
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm inclined to say years. Before we reacted, are you asking me?
Representative Torkelson.
Yes, that's my question.
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I very can't answer that. I know it wasn't an instantaneous decision. We had we started to look at the issue. We started to make determinations on what was taxable, what was not taxable, and what actually existed in the counties. And I can't give you an honest estimate even of how slow we were to react to it.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Hagan, if it took years, it seems to point out that there is some cloudiness in the fermentation tank here. Not as good.
You're done now, I trust.
No, I'm not done. It's just, it's confusing, frankly, whether or not these properties should be taxed. Any idea what percentage of them are taxed as real property today?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we have, of the 17 counties that have the tanks, 13 of them are in compliance with the Supreme Court decision in our direction. So the vast majority of them are. There's about $28 million that is attributable just to fermentation tanks and beer wells.
Representative Torkelson.
Some of these facilities are Job Z or TIF district facilities, so the decision really has no immediate effect. Is that correct?
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. In the case, getting back then to the Sugar Beet situation, were all of the tanks and vessels in the Sugar Beet facility switched to real property?
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I believe they identified 30 different types of tanks. Some were deemed to be exempt as personal property, and in this grouping of 30 tanks in the Sugar Beet case were deemed to be taxable as real property.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So some of those tanks were deemed to be part of the process, part of the personal property, and not taxed as real property.
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, some tanks, not these tanks, but some other types of tanks were deemed to be exempt as personal property.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there is, you know, the line isn't clear. I think it seems to me that you're asking us for clarification. Is that correct?
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, that is not correct. The bill's author is asking, I think.
Yeah. I think the department is clear, and they would like it to remain that way. Representative Falk is asking for a different form of clear. Representative Falk.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I did look over the latest court case decision this afternoon, and to me that was not all that clear. It seemed like the judge himself was somewhat conflicted in his the way he wrote his opinion, and I would lobby for us to clarify the situation.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. We've got a remarkable number of members who want to discuss fermentation tanks. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, the impact on the industry. But I think it's important to note that the information from the Department of Revenue highlights how this would really shift property tax burdens onto households and onto other businesses. And my understanding is that, you know, many of these are in pretty small communities. And that kind of a shift might have some significant implications for both homeowners and owners of, you know, the local gas station and other kind of businesses in the community. And I think we need to have a better understanding of what that would mean. But I think this really, within an individual community, I don't represent one of those, I think we might have some issues that the authors and others who are interpreting the impacts of this ought to think about, because it looks like it could be significant. And it looks like Mr. Hagan is nodding in agreement.
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that is correct. There's some of these do occur in some really small communities. Welcome, I believe, is one of them, which is the community of Welcome would have a pretty significant tax shift if they were exempted.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you to that point, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. I'm confused. I thought I heard earlier that you said that these things were not currently being assessed, and this is actually going to be changing in the assessment practice. Did I mistakenly hear that?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, that is certainly not what I intended to say. The current practice is to assess these fermentation tanks and beer wells are currently assessed in almost all counties. There's a couple counties that we're working on aggressively getting them to conform to the uniform standards of the rest of the counties. So embracing this bill or adopting this bill would exempt in excess of $28 million in value. That's currently taxable.
Okay, Representative
Garofalo? I'm just looking for Representative Falk. He's got a comment here because I thought I'd go ahead.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Loeffler's question or comment, I share those as well, but there is the ultimate issue here that I think that the point that some of this was put into the tax base was reached in error. And so if that error leads to shift, was it really right for that shift to have occurred in the, you know, should we not correct that? And I think that's part of the challenge here. And so when we look at these industrial processes, we typically haven't applied the real property designation to them. And so in my opinion, I think the court erred in its judgment that creates the artificial basically relief on some other properties that shouldn't have occurred in the first place. And then when we try to correct the problem, then it looks like, you know, you're shifting back. So I see your point and I understand, but this is a challenging issue. And I think to Representative Garofalo's point as well, that this is not, there have been other circumstances, namely job Z classifications, which have prevented the paying of property taxes by a number of these facilities to begin with. And so we're still in that window where, you know, how do we get all the parts sorted out and figure out what's right? Personally, I mean, I think we should look at how we apply the tax code to industrial processes. I mean, whether it's a manufacturing process, whether it's some other type of construction process or whatever it is, if we're going to be fair and uniform in what we consider to be a manufacturing process and we exempt the the parts of that process and we classify them as personal property, not real property, we should be consistent across different industries. And that's what this bill is aiming to do. I'm not nearly as eloquent as the testifiers I have, so if you have further questions, I could ask them to come back up.
Mr. Reines, it is after 5 o'clock. And this is the first time I've asked a lobbyist, did you bring treats from your client?
I did not.
Ah.
The good old days. I got a bill for that, Mr. Chair.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines, here representing Summit and Shell's Brewing Company. And I want to first and foremost thank the representative for coming forward with a bill to clarify, because I think if you read the 2007 Supreme Court case, the court was definitely struggling with where they draw the line between personal and real property. And they were almost pleading in a couple of footnotes the legislator to provide some guidance to them on this muddy issue. I don't think, I've talked to the Department of Revenue, Mr. Hagan's been great. I don't think there's any intention at this point to start taxing brewery fermentation tanks. Local assessors and the Department of Revenue have consistently and appropriately defined those as personal property, and I don't think that's going to change in the imminent future, but this is an area of uncertainty right now. I have not read the recently rendered tax court opinion, but I will be reading that. It's worth noting that the brewery fermentation tanks are housed inside an existing structure. They serve no structural function for the building they're housed in. When they're initially purchased, they actually qualify for the capital equipment sales tax refund. So I think they're a very different animal than some of the other tanks that may have been discussed. But I think this whole area about tanks and fermentation has begun very cloudy in light of the recent tax court decision and the Supreme Court decision.
Thank you, Mr. Innes. Representative Carlson, you're on the list, and then Representative Nelson. Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess Mr. Innes kind of hit on what I was thinking. What size tank are we talking about they're going to come down to if they're currently, and I think Representative Falk said when he talked about this earlier that these tanks, when they were purchased, did you say that they get the personal property exemption when they're purchased, or the capital exemption when they're purchased?
Representative Innes.
When the tanks are actually purchased, they qualify for the sales tax exemption for capital equipment. So I think it's logical to assume that in fact is personal property equipment. These tanks, I mean, the ones at Summit, I think, are about 18,000 gallons. So they're large, but they're not to the magnitude we're talking about the biofuel tanks. I think it's a different magnitude of tank, certainly. And it's certainly, Chairman, real quick, it's absolutely an important part of the processing of the beer. I mean, Mark Studwood, the founder of Summit, said if anyone wants to try our product that hasn't been in a fermentation tank, they're more than welcome to try it. But it's not going to be very appetizing beer. So I think most people would agree that the fermentation tank is an important part of the process.
But Mr. Chair,
Representative Nelson,
I think I heard in the earlier testimony that these tanks at the ethanol plants, I think that was said by one of them, that they qualify for some of that capital equipment exemption. So on one hand they're taxing them, they say they're personal property, but on the other hand now they're saying they're real property.
Representative Nelson, you've gotten enthusiastic nods from the CEO in the room.
I think we need to do something to clarify this, because I think if somebody wanted to get zealous about enforcing this court opinion, they could say those tanks would be considered real property. They could say some of the new brew pubs that are being built all around the city of Minneapolis, Representative Loeffler's district, some of the new ones that have opened up, those tanks could be considered real property, and now we could be infringing on some stuff we've been trying to do in the legislature to encourage new business in the state of Minnesota. So I think we need to do something to clarify this as we go forward. I don't know if this Representative Falk's bill is the answer, but I think we need to deal with this.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Mr. Whitman? And I don't know if Mr. Berenson wants to come down as well. Mr. Whitman, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Dan Whitman. I'm the county assessor from Martin County, and I'm here today wearing two hats, but to start with, I think I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, our legislative committee. And so I guess I would be that person in the room that Mr. Runneke referred to as the one who doesn't think there's a need for clarification. On behalf of MAO, we do feel that the Supreme Court's ruling did give us clarification and clear guidance as to how to give us clarification and clear guidance as to how to proceed with taxation on these tanks. Personally, I happen to have two of these ethanol plants in my county, and so in 2006, I was attempting to determine what should be taxable and what shouldn't be. And so the 2007 decision by the Supreme Court, I read very carefully. I still carry a copy of that decision with me a lot of the time because I felt like, it gave us great clarity. And so through that, we have been attempting over the last number of years to help to educate all assessors and to move towards equity throughout the state. And we have received assistance through education, help from the Department of Revenue. Mr. Reineke has helped us in educating for the last several years as to how you determine whether these particular structures are taxed. And we've been moving towards equity. We feel that we are very equitable throughout the state at this point. You know, our concern right now is that this bill, if it were passed, would create a great deal of inequity once again throughout the different industries in the state. And our position statement from the Association of Assessing Officers, number two, says that we support the principle of ad valorem taxation, which is based on market value as a major component of a diverse budget-based tax system. And that system should have should be based upon a fair and equitable tax base, a reliable source of revenue for the local taxing authorities, and the accountable and justifiable with similar properties, understandable and transparent. And we believe that the adjustments to market value, such as these limitations on assessors' markets and taxation acquisitions and exclusions and exemptions, creates a very inequitable situation. And so that's why the Association of Assessors is very concerned, because we do feel that this is going to create a great deal of inequity from one industry to another. In some cases, we're going to have similar structures on one side of the road being taxed differently than a similar structure on the other side of the road, because one's in an ethanol plant and one's in a sugar beet or a bean crush or some other kind of plant. And so, that's our biggest concern. We want to keep everything easily understandable. The property tax working group this year was focused on that, and that's that was kind of the result of that. And so, the assessors have supported that idea of keeping it understandable and equal between different groups, and we're just really worried that this is going to create a great deal of inequity, and it won't be long, and there'll be a number of other industries asking for similar types of adjustments based on the economics of the time, and it'll be hard to say no, because one industry is getting an adjustment now.
Thank you, Mr. Whitman.
Can I take one more step and take my hat as the Martin County Assessor?
Sure. Briefly, I should warn folks that there's another meeting in this room at 5:45.
I'll be very brief. Our county, Martin County, is very concerned. We do have one of the plants that's in a job. Both of our plants are in job zone, and each of our plants is 110 million gallons. So in Martin County, we have the capability of producing about 225 million gallons of ethanol a year. And so in encouraging those plants to be built, our local governments were supportive of putting them in the job zone as a temporary relief from taxation to get them built and running as an economic a help with the understanding the long range goal is going to be there's going to be a large expanded tax base in the future to help us pay for all of that infrastructure and all those things we did to help them come in. And so now to take a major portion in my county, it'll be $13.5 million of exemption and move that to permanent rather than a temporary adjustment to this industry is very concerning to the county commissioners, and particularly, as Mr. Hagan mentioned, the city of Welcome. The current value of the whole city of Welcome is approximately $28 million, and so to exempt $6.5 million in that one little jurisdiction, that's going to cause a pretty significant shift towards the residents in that community. They've supported producing that, helping to get that plant into production through the job zone exclusion, which was meant to be temporary, and now it's they're talking about making a major portion of that permanent, and that's of great concern to our communities and our county. So that would be my Martin County hat that I'm wearing there.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Whitman.
You're welcome.
Mr. Berenson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bo Berenson. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. Just very briefly to tag on to the comments you just heard, I was going to try to put a face on some of the tax shift that you could expect to see as a result of this bill. I think the Martin County example is a great example. That on top of that, Fillmore County, their assessor estimates that if this bill were to pass, roughly $50,000 worth of property taxes would be shifted away from these properties and other property tax owners. In Stevens County, a county of less than 10,000 people, they think that if this bill were to pass, there'd be $200,000 worth of market value shifted to the other taxpayers in the county. And I think a lot of these concerns are raised in the discussion we had before about the additional funding the state would have to provide to the property tax refund program to buy down the homestead property tax increases that could result from this bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jacobson?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
I'm sorry to slow things down. Mr. Whitman, what year was the Welcome Plant built?
Mr. Whitman.
Yes. It was built in, we started building in 2005, 2006, and I believe it didn't come online for a year, so it was ready to go in, I believe, 2007, and actually went into production in 2008.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. At the time it was built, do you believe that the builders of that plant thought that their tanks would be real property?
Mr. Whitman.
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Torkelson, I do believe that.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jacobson? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Glenn Jacobson. Excuse me, Assistant Renville County Attorney. I got involved with this as I was local Renville County Counsel on the Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar Cooperative tax cases, and actually there are two of them. There's the first one that we've been mentioning before that started in the tax court and then went to the Supreme Court. There was a second one that was heard in the district court that was appealed to the Court of Appeals, which, as obviously counsel for the prevailing side, I think the court got it very right. And I do, to a certain extent, agree that there does seem to me need to be some clarity, some additional direction. And to answer Representative Torkelson's question about the tanks at issue in the Southern Minnesota case, we made a strategic decision not to address any tanks less than 100,000 gallons. We made a strategic decision not to address any tanks within the building facilities themselves. We had many, many other issues that we were litigating. The litigant, Southern Minnesota, was proposing that what everybody referred to as thick juice storage tanks were actually process tanks. They were a part of their process. So that was a great deal of that litigation as to whether those storage tanks were or were not a part of the process. So that's what we wanted to focus on, not whether or not some smaller tank that was inside a building was or wasn't real estate, even though it was our opinion that the statute read, as it has now been determined by Judge Turner in the Guardian Energy, to be taxable real estate. We just didn't want to go there. Our concerns are echoed, as Judge Turner has just issued in Guardian, that there might be a point of ludicrous minimus. It's getting too small. The smallest tank in Guardian was 18,000 gallons. Where is there a line to be drawn? There may very well be. What it is, I don't know. The points that I want to make is that the bill as proposed is not the way to do it. The assessors need attributes, not a name, to make a determination as to what is taxable property. They need to be able to look at something, regardless of what plant they're at, what business they're at, what factory they're at, and say, this does this. This is process, or this is storage, this is real estate. Calling something a fermentation tank or a beer well, as was earlier testified to, those things weren't in existence 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. What is it going to be called in 5 or 10 years from now? If the legislature defines what is or is not taxable based on an attribute, it is part of the process, or it's a part of the storage, or it does this, or it doesn't do that, that is something that the assessors can then use over the years in making their determination. Exceptions to the taxation should also not be limited by business type. That's already been mentioned. Why are we drawing the lines between an ethanol plant on this side of the road and some other type of plant on the other side of the road that has essentially the same type of tank or vessel or bin that does essentially the same thing, but one's exempt and one's not? Now, I will grant you that if we start making these changes broader in scope, there might very well be a much greater property tax or a tax burden shifting, but that's a policy question for the legislature, not for the attorneys and the people that are dealing with it. There was a mention earlier about the cost of litigation and trying to reduce those costs by clarity. I propose to you that if we exempt a specific type of tank at a specific type of business, that is going to increase costs of litigation, not decrease them. Because everybody is going to be able to find an expert that's going to say, my business is not a listed business, but my tank is essentially the same as a listed tank, therefore I should get the benefit of the tax exemption. And that's going to cause a lot more litigation, not less. The moving parts of the factory, of the plant, of the facility are still personal property exempt from taxation. The only thing that the Guardian Energy and the other previous Southern Minnesota cases taxed are the excluded, the exterior shells, the walls, the roof, the floors, things like that. All of the currently defined process equipment is still exempt as equipment. One of the facilities at the sugar beet plant was called a Weibel bin. It is an absolutely huge, look from the outside it looks like a grain storage bin. But inside it has elevators, it has scrolls, it has a rotating arm that disperses the sugar after it has been produced and allows it to fall 60, 70 feet. And during this process, it dries, it's conditioned. There was another big argument about whether or not that Weibel bin was process equipment or real estate. And the final determination was that the exterior, double insulated wall, the roof, is taxable real estate, but all of the process equipment inside it is just that, personal property exempt. That's the type of decision that Judge Turner made in the Guardian case, and it's my opinion that she very clearly and very consistently followed the way the law is currently written. If you want to change the result, you need to rewrite the law, but it should be done at the top, not by pulling exceptions for particular parts of equipment and particular businesses.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Representative Hertas.
I think this kind of speaks to the exceptions that we do, like having 55 different classifications of property. And as we were listening to all this, I started to think about farming operation and the food processing for animals. We've got silos that are both fermentation and storage. So which is it? And, you know, you probably open a whole Pandora's box there as well.
Pandora's silo. As it were.
But whenever I've had conversations over beer, it always gets long.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Mr. Whitman, would you return for just a brief question? Please.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Jacobson just told us what we should tell the assessors. And I thought I'd ask an assessor if what he told us to tell the assessors was the right thing to tell the assessors. He said that we should identify attributes by which you would determine, if I understood him correctly, you would determine whether an item, an object, was real or personal property, and that you should that we should not do it by business type. But again, I think that goes back to the attributes, the function of the item. Would that be a different approach that would provide clarification, even if it changed what object was being deemed private or personal property versus what was being deemed real property?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not really clear as to what kind of attributes you're thinking about, because it's my understanding now that we do have a very clear definition. The Supremes upheld a tax court ruling that defined it, and that's the Supreme Court in 2007 laid out a three-step process for identifying a structure. And if at the bottom line it is a structure, then it's taxable. And now the Waseca County case that came out Monday morning, she expanded greatly on that definition, where a couple of people, it seems, were confused by, in my opinion, in the past, wanted to read that Supreme Court decision a little differently, putting an and rather than an or. In some of those statements, she has gone to great lengths and expanded and written down every instance that I've heard argued as a talking point, and said, here in these three cases, Now we have a structure that is providing temperature control, so it's taxable. In these three cases, now we have a structure that's defined as a structure, and so it's taxable. In these three cases, now we have something that's defined as something else, and it's taxable. So she took the Supreme Court's ruling, in my opinion, and expanded on it, you know, in a much longer explanation, but answered all those questions, so even giving us more clarity. So to write legislation, it seems, I don't know how that would look. I'd have to look at it to see, you know, what those definitions would be. But it is MAO's position that clearly we want things all, it's much against our position to treat a small group of taxpayers separately. Mm-hmm. We really need to treat everyone the same, and equitable is our opinion, and that's what we continuously lobby for. And so if something needs to be changed, we'd like it to be changed on everyone equally rather than defining industries or small groups that we're trying to identify.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Whitman. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify regarding House File 660 who hasn't had the opportunity? Representative Falk, any closing comments, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think to the point that some of the points Mr. Whitman brought up, I personally believe it's the legislature's responsibility to write tax policy, not the court's responsibility. And so even though the courts have provided some guidance under current statute, I do think that there are some challenges still there. I do think also that there is the ability to determine whether or not a process is taking place inside of a tank or a vessel versus just being used for storage, and we can work on that. I do think Mr. Jacobson also made some excellent points, and I'm willing to work with him on some of his suggestions. I would say, if he's still here, if I could have him come up and offer one more comment.
I think he fled.
Okay. Well, I don't want to speak explicitly for him, but one of the things he mentioned prior to coming up, and we were talking before in the hallway, is that if you were to go and take the court's interpretation to the most minute level, essentially you could go and nail a coffee cup to a table, and it would become part of the real property because it's part of a fixture, or if you nailed it to the building. And so even though that coffee cup, you know, for all intents and purposes, should be considered to be personal property because it is part of the structure, if you take this court interpretation to the most minute level, anything that could hold liquid that is affixed to the building should be assessed as real property. Now, that was what he relayed to me, and I may have misstated it. I mean, I don't want to speak exactly his words, but that was the interpretation that I got from him. So to say that this is clear is highly doubtful, and I do think that the word cloudy has been used quite frequently, and I think that's probably the best means to describe the current situation.
Representative Garofalo, last bit.
My apologies, Mr. Chairman. I should let the author finish, but I just wanted to say I wanted to thank you for bringing this bill forward, and Representative Winchesky isn't here. I wanted to thank her for the bills she brought forward in committee today. I've learned more in the Tax Committee and the Property Tax Committee today than I think I have in a long time. It's just very good selection of bills for members to understand that as much as we try to paint things for the public as black and white, right or wrong, easy, hard issues, this is a complex policy matter. Representative Falk has come forward with a bill that he's trying to solve the problem. I support the solution that he's moving forward with. And I just wanted to thank you for your selection of bills today. I thought it was incredibly informative, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Garofalo. With that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 660 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Garofalo moves acceptance of the February 19th minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion prevails. Representative Torkelson moves adoption of the February 26th minutes.
I do, sir.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.